movies that twist our understanding of reality. Boeing and its issues with the 737, and more this hour on Weekday. From 94.9 KOW Seattle, KOW.org, I'm Steve Scherr. Vaughn Palmer is political correspondent for the Vancouver Sun, joins us every Wednesday on Weekday. Hello, Vaughn.
Good morning.
Vaughn, you know, it's National Poetry Month. We just talked to two excellent poets. Do you have any favorite poems that crop up in your thinking and reading?
For some reason or another, T.S. Eliot's The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock sticks in my head more than you'd expect. Having read it in high school, it's still rattling around in there. And I know you would have expected Horatio at the Bridge or Half a League, Half a League, Half a League Onward, but it's actually Let Us Go Then, You and I, When the Evening is Spread Out Against the Sky, Like a Patient Etherized Upon a Table.
You know, Vaughn, I can always rely on you to have an interesting answer to something, because you didn't know I was going to ask you.
Well, I got a few limericks, too, but those won't work on the radio. It was a young girl from Seattle, for example.
Yeah, we won't go there.
Sorry.
Tell me something. Any poets among the people who are running to head the country of your origin?
We got a shortlisted Booker Prize writing novelist.
Yeah, there you go.
Michael Ignatieff. I mean, this guy's, 15, 20 books? Prof at Harvard? International credentials all over the place. You'd think we'd be putting them on the stamps or at least declaring Michael Ignatieff Day in Canada, but instead he is the target of one of the nastiest attack ad campaigns I've seen in a while, and that's saying something.
Really? What did he do to garner such attention?
Well, the government of Prime Minister Stephen Harper has decided to attack Ignatieff for coming back to Canada and running for Prime Minister. And the message is, he didn't come back for you. It's, as I said, a very nasty, parochial ad campaign playing off the, I guess what you'd say is, Ignatieff was out of the country for 30 years. He lived in the UK for a long time. He lived in the United States. He, I think, spent enough time in the United States that he on occasion referred to Americans as we. And when he came back in 2006 to seek a seat in the Canadian Parliament, so he's been back for 5 years, there was a thought at the time that maybe this was kind of a class project. You had a prof at Harvard who decided to run for Prime Minister of Canada, and maybe it was going to make another book. But he stuck around. He lost a nasty leadership fight in the Liberal Party in 2006. Stuck with it, won the leadership of the party in 2009, and is now leading the party in this election campaign. And I think as I said, the idea that he was sort of stopping over for the weekend to see what the old turf was doing should be long gone. But they're still running. As I said, this is like a theme of the government's attack ads on our leader of the opposition, Ignatieff, is he didn't come back for you.
So he's the Neil Young of politics.
Well, this is interesting because, you know, we're a big country geographically, but a small country in terms of population. And a lot of Canadians go abroad for one reason or another. They go abroad to study. They go abroad to see other parts of the world. They go abroad because we're a country of immigrants. About 3 million Canadians live abroad. I mean, people with Canadian citizenship live abroad. And, yeah, you mentioned Neil Young. A lot of our hockey players are artists. Our writers, I noticed I sent you a piece from the National Post by one of our best columnists, Robert Fulford, pointing out that, you know, Mordecai Richler lived 20 years in London. Nobody doubted that he was still one of the great novelists about the experience of growing up Jewish in the city of Montreal, that he was anything less authentic because of it. Mavis Galland is a Quebecer. She lived in Paris most of her life as a writer. Neil Young, yeah, he lives on a ranch near San Francisco. You know, he's worshipped by musicians in this country. He is one of our great songwriters. Yeah, he's got a whole song about it, going back to Canada on a journey through the past, right?
We'd have a tough time with our comedy if we didn't have Canadians down here doing it.
That's a good point. Our great comic actors. I always throw in William Shatner on the list, but there he is. I mean, we are a nation as is true. I think of a lot of smaller nations. You do have a lot of your people go abroad for one reason or another, and. As I said, I mean, you've heard me say it, I think, on the show today. I think it's an unseemly attack. I don't know whether it's going to backfire or not. They've been running these ads for a while, but it is kind of an appeal to the parochial in Canada, the little Canadians. And whatever else happens in the campaign, I hope this is the last we've heard of this thing.
Well, it's interesting they made that choice. Something in their polling told them that there must be a way to have some impact with that attack.
Yeah, and, you know, Canadians do have an issue. There's no getting away from it. Canadians do have an issue with the United States. You know, we live and work in the shadow of the United States. American culture is dominant. Canadians don't want to be like the United States in terms of taxes and social programs and health care, so it's a common theme. And look, conservative parties in Canada, including Stephen Harper, have been targeted for attack ads in the past for trying to bring U.S.-style health care to Canada or something like that. So it is attack ads aren't confined to one party, and unfair accusations aren't confined to one party either. But, you know, I talked to you about Harper last week, about some of the other candidates running for prime minister, and certainly with Ignatieff, this has been the theme early in the campaign, is what's this guy up to? There have been two negative attacks, the one I just mentioned, he didn't come home for you, and the other one, that he's scheming with the opposition parties in Canada to form some kind of coalition of the left, of the center-left, and perhaps even in partnership with a separatist party, the Bloc Québécois.
How is the Green Party candidate's attempt to get into the nationally televised debates going?
Failed. So we have televised debates. They go, the big one goes next week, Tuesday. In the last election in Canada, we had five leaders on the set. So you had the Liberal leader of the opposition, you had the Prime Minister, you had the New Democratic Party, the Party of the Left, you had the leader of the Bloc Québécois, the Separatist Party, and you had the Greens. They gave the Greens a seat. Argued that there was a member of Canada's Parliament who'd switch parties. He wasn't elected as a Green, but he'd switched to Greens. So Greens were represented, and they were recognized as a party in Canada. They had qualified for federal funding for political parties, so they gave the Green leader a seat. This time, the consortium of broadcast companies that put together the debate left them out. They argued that the Greens didn't have a seat in Parliament, that they had won anything in the last election, and so the Green leader, Elizabeth May, did not qualify. She protested. They filed a challenge in court. A judge yesterday ruled that there simply was not enough time for the courts to sort out this issue. He wasn't prepared to issue an injunction. So the debate, as things stand today anyway, is going to go ahead next Tuesday without Elizabeth May, the Green leader, having a seat.
How's that play in the wider field?
General public view from the opinion polls I've seen, from the phone-ins on radio and the letters to the editor and emails, suggest the public is sympathetic to May. They think she deserves a seat at the table. It's not overwhelming. It's not a national outrage, but a lot of sympathy for her. She may be able to capitalize on that. She's trying to win a seat in Parliament so that the Greens do have that presence nationally. She's running in a suburb here of the capital, Victoria, in Saanich, and she may win. She may be able to capitalize on this sympathy outcry that people say, all right, well, next time she will have a seat in Parliament. Here you go, Elizabeth. So maybe she can turn it to her advantage. It doesn't at this point look like she's got much legal recourse to get into the debate.
Well, we'll have to check that. That will be interesting. What about Ignatieff, Mr. Ignatieff, by the way? I mean, he's lauded by so many of his colleagues. He is, as you say, this well-respected, this well-written person. Does he have a future if he loses?
It's an awkward transition from being an intellectual and an academic to politics. And, you know, he's said and written a lot of stuff that, you know, they can use against you in politics. But I think people that are used to communicating, you know, if you think of communicating as a novelist or communicating as a university professor or as a writer of serious nonfiction, all those things don't necessarily suit you for the kind of communication you have to do as a politician. In sound bites, simplifying things, I think, for public consumption, responding directly to more populist issues. So it has been a tough transition for Ignatieff, and he doesn't whine about this. You know, he sort of accepts that he's quite open about having made a lot of mistakes. He's open about, you know, it's a lot tougher than he thought it was going into it, but he says it should be. You know, he says, why shouldn't it be tough? It's you want to run the country. And people want to scrutinize you, and they know that if you get elected, the election is their chance to hold you to account. So, you know, I think, I hate to say it, I think he will get a very interesting book out of this if he doesn't win the election. But I don't think that's why he's doing it. I mean, I think, as I said, I think he's demonstrated a commitment now of 5 years to it. And look, it's a subject of political debate whether or not he's serious. But as I said, I think he's shown he is, and... I mean, if he loses the election, his party will probably look for a new leader, but that's normally what political parties do when they lose elections. It's not really your choice, in fact, as a leader, whether or not they do. Now, if he does better than expected, you know, we also play the expectations game in elections, Steve, and he started with pretty low expectations. So if he does better than expected, and so far he is, well, then maybe you do get another shot at it, even if you don't win a majority the first time.
Yeah, well, you have this poll. Jack Layton of the NDP gets 34%, if Ignatieff, 17%, and Stephen Harper, 49%. So
the polls are all over the map.
Oh, is that right?
In Canada. And the other thing is our polls, national polls, tend to be almost meaningless because you really have to drill down to the regional level. Vote patterns differ so widely across the country. I would say at this point in the campaign, and voting day is the 2nd of May, I would wait till late in the campaign to see what the polls say and look only at detailed regional results.
Okay, well, I hope we get more mudslinging because that's what makes a campaign useful. All right.
People say that our negative ads are not as nasty as some of the negative ads that... sort of world-class negative stuff that they do in some of the races in the United States. And I guess that's true. And there's some funny stuff up here, too, and I think that's probably being more effective, is humor works, I think, better than the real nasty stuff. But nevertheless, you know, the suggestion of this guy's some kind of carpetbagger come back to try to, you know, show we inferior people how to run our affairs, it can get pretty nasty. I mean, that's the tone of the attack ad. So.
Well, he should just walk around with a hockey stick. All right, Vaughn, thanks for talking to us again.
Next week.
Vaughn Palmer, political course.
Poetry.
Yeah, well.
I'll read you a passage in one of Ignatieff's novels next week. That should build your audience.
I interviewed him. He was very interesting. I talked to him.
He
had a lot to say. All right, we'll see if, okay. And you know, Stephen Harper could come down here and write some books if he wants to,
there
too.
There you go. Yeah.
All right, take care, Vaughn.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. It's weekday.
Food prices are steadily rising all over the world, but not at the same pace everywhere you go. We'll take a look at why there's a discrepancy in global food prices. That's tonight at 6:30.
Support for KUOW comes from Monkey, this Friday, April 8th, presenting Scala Choir, the performers of Creep from the Social Network trailer at Showbox Sodo. Tickets for Scala are available at Ticketmaster and at the door.
94.9 KUOW News and Information. It's coming up on 10:21. 44 degrees, overcast in Seattle. We're expecting a high today of 48. The forecast calls for clouds and showers with a chance of thunderstorms. Clouds and showers tonight, chance of evening thunderstorms. The overnight low near 35.
All right, then. And now we turn to the cultural moment with Robert Horton, who writes for the Herald and Everett, reviews the cultural moment for a weekday every Wednesday, and also at the Crop Duster, his blog, and a monthly series of discussions, The Magic Lantern, at the Fry Art Museum. Free. Right.
Yes, free.
Free. Do you have another one coming up soon?
Pretty soon.
Do you know what it is yet?
Yes. We'll be showing the Red Shoes.
Oh, that's right.
The famous classic film.
Hence we discussed.
Yeah.
Okay, so I heard that the topic that you had considered, and by the way, I appreciate that I make you pick the topic now. So it's much easier for me.
That's right.
And you know. I heard that you wanted to discuss films that challenge our perception of reality. Don't all films do that? By their
yes.
very nature?
Well,
they're not real. They're films.
Yes, they are. That is quite true. Every time you go into a movie, you are agreeing to participate in an alternate version of reality. Otherwise, we wouldn't go to movies.
Not at all.
Why isn't reality itself fine?
Yeah. Why don't we just watch the birds and the bees?
Indeed. But we've chosen that, and that is so. But we're talking about a level of films in which there's a kind of an unspoken bargain when you go into a movie that even though you are doing this unreality thing, what you see is sort of like reality, and it's ordered in a way that's very familiar to us from long before cinema was invented because of various storytelling forms and such. And so there's a certain contract that in most movies we kind of expect. And it's intriguing to me that just lately there have been a bunch of films that have said, okay, here is that movie reality, once removed from the real thing, I guess, that you expect, and we're going to layer on top of that a bunch of other sorts of realities. And we won't necessarily tell you which is which or where you are at any given moment. And I've just wondered why are we seeing those now? And
why are we in that era now, huh?
Yeah. And, there was a time, I think, when there was kind of a classic art house association with that sort of thing. You think of last year at Marion Bod and that sort of era of the foreign film of the late 50s, early 60s. And
Godard films?
Yeah. And Antonioni, perhaps.
Sure. Sure.
I mean, Blow Up was a actual box office success, and you didn't really know what was going on there.
Yeah.
What had happened? Had anything happened? And for some reason, just lately, it seems to me that we are kind of seeing a lot of those movies again. And some of them are the puzzle film, which sort of, I don't know if it was already here by the time Memento came around, but Memento is one of those movies that is a puzzle film. And in part because the internet exists, you get to sort through it endless times after you've seen it. And you get to see it as many times as you want to, of
freeze
course, as
the
well.
Frame.
And
look
that,
for the clues.
You know, so there's a movie that you can actually kind of feel like, I can solve this. There, you know, when you put it all together, it will mean this thing. But there's also a kind of film that may also be puzzling, but you can't put it together. And that is even more intriguing, I think. I was listening to your poetry show that you did, and the point was well made that this is not a matter of saying this means this, because that's kind of a dead piece of art.
Yeah.
And the richer variety is, what does this mean? And then you have to work at it and you have to live through it. And maybe these kinds of alternate reality movies are encouraging that impulse. I guess we should name some of the titles.
But before perhaps. You do, one of the ones that got you thinking about this was a new movie, Source Code, right?
Source Code is one of them, yeah.
All right, so here's a little taste of Source Code.
Right.
Welcome back, Captain Stevens.
Where am I?
You are inside the Source Code.
What is the Source Code?
It's a computer program, Captain.
Source Code enables you to cross over into another man's identity in the last 8 minutes of his life.
At 7:48 this morning, a bomb exploded on a train outside of Chicago, killing everyone on board. A man named Sean Fentress was on that train. He is now you. Think, Captain, remember back. Who bombed the train?
I don't know who bombed the train!
Then try again. We've been informed there'll be another attack in 6 hours. If you find the bomber, the next attack can be prevented. Concentrate on the passengers in your car. Look for ones who seem nervous. As always, you will have 8 minutes.
8 minutes, and then I blow up again.
As always, you'll have 8 minutes.
Yeah.
It's a little bit of a video game, huh?
Yes. Source Code would not be one of the heavier examples of this this format, but it's a fun movie. It actually is. And the thing that happens in it, that makes it sound like you kind of know what it is, but it turns out it's a little more complicated than that. And you don't find out everything that's going on until it's fairly well into the movie. And it presents a scenario in which this 8 minute section of time keeps being repeated over and over again. You see it like 10 times during the movie.
Really?
Yeah, the same thing. So it's the Groundhog Day of exploding train movies, I think. But
who knew we had a category like that?
Well, this is it. This may be the end point of that. But it is an example of kind of playing around with reality. Maybe not in a deep metaphysical way, but certainly in that case in kind of a fun way.
By the way, did you enjoy it? It was fun.
Source Code is fun.
Fun.
Yeah.
Fun.
Yeah.
I like that the man's voice, the other man's voice. Was straight out of, I don't know, anime or something that we had a computer version.
I think there's a very eccentric performance by the actor Jeffrey Wright in this film that's kind of a lot of fun to watch.
Oh, is that Jeffrey Wright?
Yeah, he's the mastermind behind this. There's also a film out now called Adjustment Bureau, which is based on a Philip K. Dick story.
That's Matt Damon's in there, right?
Yes, and Philip K. Dick was something of an expert in this kind of what is reality scenario, and I thought Adjustment Bureau was not as much fun as Source Code, and I think it doesn't come off at all.
Why is it? Did they take themselves more seriously, or it just wasn't as...
They did, and I think it's kind of compromised by the turning it into a romance, so it becomes a kind of a romance film. Yeah, right.
Philip K. Dick probably didn't have it as a romance, did he?
He did not. Yeah. He did not in his short story version, but it is a guy living his life, suddenly discovering that there's an entire... nexus of controllers that are out there actually dictating what we do, which you may have suspected all along.
I have often felt that.
There's a film out called Sucker Punch right now, which is by the director of, the visionary director, as he's described in the ads, of 300 and Watchmen. Zack Snyder's is his name.
Really? Visionary? Those are visionary films.
That's what they say. That's
all
what
right.
They tell me.
Very
and
cool.
This film was his big, this was his, those were based on other things, and this was his first original script, and it was going to be this, boy, this, he's the next, you know, fill in the blank, Christopher Nolan, Martin Scorsese, who knows? And the movie has gotten the worst reviews of any film of the last couple of years.
Wow, who's in this film?
A cast mostly of young women who are scantily dressed. Oh, yes, they are punching each other, too. It's a film that starts with a young woman being put into what appears to be an insane asylum, which then becomes a kind of, it's hard to tell what it is, a bordello or a cabaret of some kind. And within that, it then becomes a series of what look like video games involving Nazi robots and dragons, and the women who are the heroines of the film go through a series of battles with these foes.
Nazi robots.
And it's a real, yeah, I think they were Nazis.
Were there zombies in there by any chance?
I think they were zombie robots, actually, which is not easy to do. And it's a really a disastrous film, and it wants to operate on the level of, hey, what's reality? You know, what are you really watching? Are you watching the first story about this young woman who gets put into an insane asylum, or have we taken off into, you know, and all that kind of stuff? And you don't care at all because there's such a lack of engagement, and it's so goofy, and it's quickly becoming kind of the Ishtar of 2011, I guess. But it's still out there. I mean, it's still, for some reason, this gathering of these films is happening. Inception obviously came out last year and did this was both a box office success, you know, and played around with kind of teasing you with what you were watching and how you could figure it out.
All the way through the end.
All the way right to the end. And I would say that kicked this off, but most of these films had to have been in production by the time Inception came out. So I'm not really the success of that doesn't entirely explain this series of films.
So are there others in the past that qualify? And you mentioned some others, and why are we in this at this point? What's going on? Is there something going on? Is there something cultural, or is it just that somebody has an idea and everybody says, oh, I'm going to try to do a movie like that?
Well, the latter part of it has to be, partly true.
Yeah.
The people I think saw the success of movies like not even Inception, but Memento. To me, there's something about the fact that the internet is a daily part of our lives now that somehow feeds into this, because there's that aspect of you see the movie, but then you go home and you watch your illegally downloaded copy of the movie. No, you don't. But a lot of people do. And then you just get online and you start sorting through it with all the other people who are thinking about it and who want to talk about it and who want to say that you're wrong and they're right and so on. And also just they genuinely want to learn and hear other people's ideas about it. Because
it's ambiguous. Because it leaves you asking questions about what not right. it's about, but what it means.
Because there are all these open doors in films like this. And, you know,
more poets are making movies and TV shows. Because I was thinking Lost is that way. And then we've had a couple other TV shows that have – series that have picked up from Lost trying to follow that same – something about the world exploding and people passing out. Nobody knows why there was that show. And
Lost is, you know, an example of that kind of going on every week where an audience is actually willing to – sit there and it not only are they not frustrated by an ultimate revelation, but that becomes a huge part of the fun of watching it.
And because what you said about the internet, Lost becomes an internet-based discussion.
Yeah, you carry it over from the actual hour of the week that you're watching it or the 2 hours that you spent watching the movie.
But you have to do a good job for it to be compelling. Unlike Sucker Punch.
People are arguing about Sucker Punch online, but it's not worth it.
Somebody also said that this is the anniversary of the Matrix movies. They came out at some point.
Has it been 10 years?
Has it been 10 years?
It's been longer than 10 years, I think.
Wow. Well, in any event, they were an example. Of course, 1999, you're right.
Yeah.
12 years.
Yeah, the Matrix certainly challenged the idea that audiences needed to have everything. Hollywood believes that everything has to be spelled out, of course, and yet these movies keep coming along that suggest that maybe that's not entirely true, like The Matrix.
We like the ambiguity. We can at least engages us. So maybe that's interesting. Is it the web? Is it our appreciation of more complex ideas? I mean that notion that the poets were talking about, ambiguity being a way for us to not just be engaged in the work, but that is how work best addresses. We don't want to be lectured to. We want to think about it.
Well, I hope it represents some sort of evolution in something or other, in a mindset where there's the possibility of these that you can leave doors open
in
a poem or a movie or a TV series or whatever it is, and not only is that does that not have to be maddening to you, but it might lead you into something else.
That's interesting. Well, what do you folks think? 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869. Join us here on this conversation before we end this segment. That's very interesting because, people get mad sometimes when you have an inauthentic narrator in a novel, right? Am I reading the novel? Is it the truth of the novel, or is the narrator who the writer has presented me as the truth teller not telling me the truth as I read these stories or this story? I shouldn't say people get mad. Sometimes people are intrigued and drawn by that. But you have this other thing that occurs, right, where the novelist itself, himself or herself, might be lying to me.
And there's a couple of examples of what you would call art house movies that have done this as well. I saw a film that won't open for a couple of weeks, so I won't say too much about it, but it's called Meek's Cutoff. By the Portland-based director who did Wendy and Lucy a couple of years ago. Kelly Reichardt is her name. And it looks like a Western, and about halfway through it, you begin to get the feeling that this is not going to end like most Westerns. And that, in fact, a lot of people will be unhappy with the ending, I think. But it had to end that way. It's kind of an experimental film, and I can't say more about it than that. But maybe after it opens, we can talk about it.
Very interesting.
But the other film that opens on Friday and that I really recommend to people, and that is the film that actually brought this up for me as a topic, is called Certified Copy. And this is a film by the director who is probably the best known director from Iran, Abbas Kiarostami is his name. And it's his first film made outside Iran, actually. Juliette Binoche is in it. There's his first movie where he's actually worked with an actor, a professional actor. And because mostly he doesn't believe in that kind of thing for himself. And it is a film that begins with a man giving a book lecture in Tuscany. He's written a book that talks about what is an original in art and what is a copy in art and what is the difference and why is there a difference and who cares. And Juliette Binoche plays a woman who meets him, wants to see him, maybe take him out for a ride since he's an Englishman who's there as a visitor. And they spend this day together talking. So it's one of those talking movies where you're watching two people go through it. But in the course of the movie, you suddenly start to – they suddenly don't seem like strangers. And you have to say, are we watching two people who have known each other before? And is it possible that they were even married before, even though – they just met. We saw them just meet. And the movie goes on like that, kind of teasing you, and it does not answer those questions. And it's a film that has caused, you know, even though it's not The Matrix, but there are online places where you can see people arguing about it. And a lot of it is trying to fit a movie like this into the Memento puzzle box and saying, look, this is how you solve it. It's this. They were once married. Da 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 da. And I would say that it's one of those films that doesn't need that, and that shouldn't get that, but that you might think of as a sort of an essay on the topic of a couple or couples or men and women, and they just happen to be played by the same two actors who go through different phases of what appears to be a relationship.
Really?
Yeah.
It might be that.
That's a way to think about it.
Huh. See, this is where we get into that question of what am I suspending and what am I asked to believe?
Right. And to me, Kiarostami in this movie, he takes you much more, it's much more intriguing than, I enjoyed Memento. Memento is really fun. But this one, there isn't an answer. I mean, there is no cue in the movie that's going to, you know, make you, oh, okay, I've discovered it.
I see.
You just have to live with it.
The top is still spinning.
And I have to tell you, it's spellbinding. The movie is absolutely spellbinding.
Well, Juliette Binoche.
She is very good. And so is her co-star, who's an opera singer who never acted before.
Huh. All right, so real quick before we're done here. Jim in Seattle, you're looking at Zabriskie Point, huh?
Right. The word spellbinding is key. The highest quality of movie-going experience for me is when I feel absolutely compelled afterwards to just go for a really long walk, just completely absorbed in the atmosphere of the film. And Zabriskie Point was one of the first times that happened to me. And also the music of Philip Glass is a kind of a really good metaphor for what I'm describing. And of course, he did such a wonderful score for the movie The Hours, which also was a film after which I just irresistibly had to go for a very long walk, just so absorbed by it.
I'm trying to even remember what Zabriskie Point was about. Was it about anything? There were people in the desert, and they were...
Right.
That's how it ends, yeah.
That's how it ends? They end in the desert?
I'm wondering how the filmmaker, the photographer in particular, was able to capture the sequences I recall of Jack Nicholson just kind of wandering in the desert, and how he was able to. Was it just from the camera angle?
You know, you're it's funny, you're putting together two Antonioni movies.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and not inappropriately either. The Nicholson movie is The Passenger.
Yeah.
And Zabriskie Point is an earlier Antonioni film.
With Rod Taylor.
Yeah. It's got some young actors in it. Yeah. It ends in the desert, and the passenger begins in the desert. So actually, and they're both directed by the same guy, so it's
isn't that sort of Antonioni's mark, to leave us confused of his films?
He was he's one of the masters of ambiguity in all the best senses. And I love the caller's idea of just having to go for a long walk after you see an Antonioni movie, and I hope you go see Certified Copy because I think you'll want to have a long walk after
the same
that
way,
well.
Huh?
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah.
Interesting. Jim, thanks for that. All right, and Rob and Redmond, I Am Cheese. I don't know I Am Cheese.
Oh, it's I Am the Cheese.
Oh, I Am the Cheese.
There was a book that we had to read in ninth grade, and it also had a film, and this was a movie that dealt with a young man struggle with a mental disorder,
huh.
And then the way that the movie plays out, as he's going through his adventures, you realize that he's actually just on the grounds of an institution. So he has, you know, he whips up these ideas that his parents are spies and this, that, and the other. This is a formula that sort of got played again and again. There was a movie called A Beautiful Mind with Russell Crowe that dealt with sort of the same issues, a mathematician.
But that was less a puzzle, right? That movie was less a puzzle, wasn't it? Beautiful Mind? We always
it's sort of on the theme of these alternate realities where the viewer isn't sure. And then there was a Leonardo DiCaprio movie, I believe it was called The Island, that was out just a few years ago, where he thinks he's a detective or a police officer coming
Shutter
to
Island.
Investigate maybe a murder or something.
Shutter Island,
And about halfway through the movie, I'm going, this is I Am the Cheese all over
again.
I'd already figured it out.
Right.
And I just wanted to share that those three movies are sort of examples of today's theme.
Yeah.
Yeah, we didn't mention Shutter Island, but that certainly dovetails in here pretty nicely.
Yeah. What were you going to say, Rob? Are you done? Rob's done.
Oh yeah, I wanted to share those films.
Yeah.
How they the filmmakers take us through this journey where you're like, "Oh, this is cool. This is interesting." And these people have interesting lives, and then
Surprise. They
drop the bomb on you in the last 5 minutes. Like, oh, okay, well.
Surprise! All right, Rob, thanks.
Goes back to the cabinet of Dr. Caligari.
I guess it does.
Yep.
Devin on Vashon, in art in general, is what? The restraint is important in these questions? Devin? Nobody's talking to me today.
All right,
well, then I will let
he's going to leave that ambiguous.
Yeah, that's how he should. Well, he should. I'll let Clarence end it. Clarence, what film were you thinking about?
I was thinking of David Lynch's Mulholland Drive, which is not to be confused with Mulholland Falls. It's one where Naomi Watts is a beautiful actress, and she's going through this adventure in Los Angeles, an aspiring actress. She should have gotten a Best Academy Award nomination for that role she did, because she played two characters, and this dream is, the movie is very hypnotic and surreal, and at the end you find out, at least in my interpretation, it was a dream of hers. But other people have other interpretations.
Yeah,
of that.
Right. Yeah.
You remember that film?
Oh, yeah. It too, is a spellbinder, absolutely.
I guess David Lynch would be one of those filmmakers who also is trying to be ambiguous through most of his filmmaking, isn't he?
He likes to walk that line.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Wasn't that the name of a David Lynch film?
Not that one, but...
I thought you were being funny. All right, Clarence, I appreciate that. And that reminds me, is Black Swan part of this?
I think
genre?
Black Swan was on my list of that, too, where there is at least the sense of, in somebody's mind is kind of what you're watching.
So do you think part of this also might be, you talked about the internet, but part of this might also be the influence of video games? Because in video games, there are many things you have to that you have to figure out. You get to do it over and over again until you figure out, oh, I need to go through that door and pick this up in order for this to succeed. Or I need to, it's always challenging you to puzzle out what's happening.
Right. And in the sense there are sort of an endless number of variations of things that could go on. I guess so, but I do think there's something about movies that really lend themselves to this idea of you don't have that choice while the movie is – you're not opening those doors.
Right.
The movie is kind of showing you what it wants to show you and leaving you to sort it out.
Yeah, and you're there. It's not like you're turning it off and walking away or coming back. You're there. All right, so remind us again of the movies that we should see that follow these ones that are opening up right now.
Well, I enjoyed Source Code. It's a good popcorn movie. But the movie to see on Friday is Certified Copy with Juliette Binoche.
And Sucker Punch only if you want to be sucker punched.
I wouldn't go there.
By a bad film.
And not even that.
All right.
Go rent an Ed Wood movie instead.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
All right. Fair enough. Robert Horton, how's the comic book, by the way? How's Rotten?
Excellent. Go get a copy of Rotten.
Right.
Rotten number 9 out now.
Zombie
issue
West?
Issue number 9, yep.
Soon to be in a major motion picture, I think. Robert Horton is a film critic, longtime contributor to KUOW. Every Wednesday he comes here with the Cultural Moment. You can read his reviews in the Herald. From Everett, and also on his blog, The Crop Duster. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Steve.
This is Weekday. Thank you for your phone calls and sharing with us.
Two state senators have introduced an education reform bill that would lay off teachers based on quality rather than seniority. The bill would allow principals to fire teachers who don't improve and give merit pay to good teachers. What do you think of that proposal? We'll learn more at noon today, and we welcome your thoughts right now at our feedback line, 206-221-3663. That's 206-221-3663.
Support for KUOW comes from Pacific Science Center, presenting Star Wars, Where Science Meets Imagination, through May 8th. The exhibit explores the futuristic technologies found in the Star Wars films and compares them with real-world scientific progress. More information at pacificsciencecenter.org.
This week on This American Life, in 1996, a rumor went around in the logging camps of Brazil. A wild man had been spotted in the jungle, the last of his tribe.
There's the Garden of Eden kind of idea that he's alone in the middle of, you know, the forest.
Where there's ample food and he picks fruit and he hunts animals.
But that's one kind of way to look at it. Another way is that he's trapped in this post-apocalyptic horror story.
That's this week.
This American Life, Friday night at 7 and Saturday morning at 11. 44 degrees, overcast in Seattle. We're expecting clouds and showers today with a chance of thunderstorms this afternoon. Today's high reaching 48. Clouds and showers tonight. The low near 35.
It's weekday on KUOW. I'm Steve Scherer. Michael J. Parks has a personal website, michaeljparks.com.
Just getting going. It looks like a beginner site, but it'll get better.
We can read your thoughts and your writings and your musings there.
Absolutely, and look at recent presentations, PowerPoint.
You're all dressed up with somewhere to go, huh?
I'm giving a speech right nearby Ivor Salmon House at starting at 11:30.
What will you be speaking of?
Oh, the Northwest economy.
Of course, because Michael Parks is editor emeritus of the Marple's Northwest Business Letter, a resource about the economy and companies of the Pacific Northwest and Alaska. Speaking of altered reality, you're in an airplane and you look up and there's a gaping hole.
Yikes. 37,000 feet, oxygen masks drop down, plane goes into what must have been just a terrifying 4-minute dive from roughly flight altitude to about 10,000 feet where you get normal oxygen. What followed, particularly what Boeing said yesterday, to me was extraordinary. You rarely hear anybody from corporate America say mea culpa, and Boeing engineers said yesterday that we made a mistake. We had figured that the risk of metal fatigue, of cracking on these older generation 737s, generally produced from early 1980 through 1999, none had been produced of this generation since 1999. We had thought that there would not be a risk of metal fatigue until the planes had experienced 60,000 cycles, a cycle being a takeoff and landing. Yesterday, Boeing said we were wrong. The plane that blew its top, if you will, had 40,000 cycles, and Boeing has concluded that we need to inspect these older airplanes at 30,000 cycles, and until we understand the problem, we're going to require even more frequent inspections.
See, I thought that was also telling, that they still are trying to figure out just exactly what's happening.
Right. And in fact, they had done a patch. They had done a redesign of the lap joints in question. And I believe that redesign was done in 1993. And they said that planes built after 1993, until you get to 60,000 cycles, don't worry about metal fatigue. Now, this is an issue, especially for Southwest,
yeah,
which flies more 737s than any other carrier, flies more Boeing planes than any other carrier, and significantly rides them very hard. One of the reasons that Southwest is noted for low prices is because it gets six or more cycles out of its 737s every day. You know that the cabin crew on Southwest helps clean the cabin when you go to the gate. If you are an airline manager, you want your airplanes in the air. They don't produce any revenue when they're sitting on the ground, and that, in a sense, is Southwest's mantra. And so the necessity to inspect these airplanes every 500 flights, roughly every 4 or 5 months, is going to impose costs on Southwest. It's going to affect its cost structure. And, of course, sudden events like this affect everybody, partly because most airplanes today are flying with load factors between 90 and 100%. And when a flight gets canceled, it's a difficult time getting people where they want to go within a reasonable period.
Is there any silver lining on this? Does it mean that some of these airlines might have to expand their fleets a bit?
Yes, it could mean that. It does pose, in the long term, reputational risk for Boeing. We don't want, you and I as airline passengers and your listeners, don't want to be worrying as we use these marvelous machines. And I remind myself every time I get on an airplane, they are incredibly marvelous machines. We take them for granted, and we know statistically that we're safer when we're in that aluminum tube, literally almost than when we're anyplace else, including driving to the airport and parking in the parking lot.
Yeah, so Boeing has, I mean, it doesn't necessarily help Boeing, though, because they're already dealing with a backlog on some of these planes.
Absolutely. They've got, the 787, the Dreamliner, 3 years late now. We did have an expression of confidence that I mentioned last week. James Bell, the CFO, recently said we're going to raise the dividend, which suggests that they've got the 787 delay in hand. But think about this. The 787 involves a lot of use of a new high-tech material, carbon fiber, in the fuselage. And it raises the question, what sort of fatigue risks arise with the use of that material? I'm not an aerospace engineer. The material has been used for a long time in the defense industry, so perhaps we have good experience with that. But it does raise questions. Now, in terms of the regional economy, the news from Boeing dating clear back to last summer has been pretty good. The backlog is increasing. A month ago, we had this huge win, the Air Force tanker contract, which is going to extend the 737-67 life at Everett. We've had senior Boeing executives say that we're going to increase production of the 737 at Renton today, roughly one a day in a few years, one and a half a day, 40, 42. So, most of the news has been good about Boeing. This is a tough one. I guess the good news is the airplane can fall apart in the sky and nobody gets hurt. But the bad news is there's going to be more interruption for passengers. There are going to be more cost for Boeing's customers until they figure out what's the root cause here.
Yeah. All right, we don't have enough time to discuss this whole issue, but I just want to ask you one thing about the idea of you were taking it off of the university's problems, University of Washington, looking around and saying, we're going to have to cut the admissions for in-state students, and we're going to bring in more out-of-state students because we can get more money from them. I think if you walk around the campus, you see new dormitories being built. Those dorms are being built to house students coming from other places, sure, because they're going to bring more money in.
Right.
Danny Westneat this morning argued in the Times, and other people have said it too, look, this is what we asked for when we asked government to operate more like a business.
Sure.
When people complain about, why aren't I getting my straight-A student into the University of Washington, don't they have only themselves to say, well, this is the decision we've made about what we think government offers us? You quoted Martin Wolf saying, we're in the era of no money. But aren't we really in the era of, this is what we're going to do, This is who gets to keep their money and who doesn't get to keep their money. This is what we're going to do with the money. It's not that we have no money. It's that we have decided, as Paul Ryan showed us, we're not taxing. We're just cutting.
I mean, we live in an era when we want it all. We want strong universities because we know that's going to determine our economic future. We want the roads paved. We want the potholes filled. We want the library open 7 days a week and preferably 10, 12, 14 hours a day. And by the way, we want low taxes. And those taxes that we do have, we prefer that they be paid by someone else. And, of course, the reality is we can't have it all. I understand the university's problem. It essentially is saying what the city is saying to people who want to park on the street. You have to pay user fees because the tax subsidy that we previously enjoyed has gone away. I used the era of no money. That was actually a phrase created by a columnist for the London Times. Isn't the internet wonderful? We have access to these things. Daniel Finkelstein, he created it 2 years ago. He said we're essentially broke. But what Wolf said was that the financial crisis pulled forward by 10 years the fiscal problems that we knew would come with the retirement of the baby boomers.
But are we broke? It's not. I mean, and when you
we're
say
not
we,
broke.
We want we're not we broke. Want other people to pay it.
Right.
It's some people are paying.
Yeah.
We're saying we don't think people with a lot of money should have to pay the kind of taxes they were paying 50 years
yes.
ago.
Yes. Yeah. You could say that. Are we broke? The casino parking lots tend to be full. The Husky Stadium, the baseball stadium, the football stadium. It's a question of our priorities, and of course, that's a broader question than you and I can settle in our short time together.
Oh, I think we can settle it, sir.
We can try.
MichaelJParks.com is Michael Parks's website. You can see what he's doing as well. And yes, we'll continue this conversation.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Good to be here.
Andy Hirst is our engineer. Weekdays produced by Katie Sewell, Sage Van Wing, Dave Blanchard. Also producing today, Amina Al-Saadi taking your calls. Tomorrow, we're going to take a look at longevity and how we can live for a long time. And let's just suppose, this being National Poetry Month, that you had listened to 2 hours. What poem would you say best revealed itself through your listening? You would share that with us on the Weekday on KUOW page. And we will try to do that for the rest of this month. What poem, after listening for this last hour or two, sparked your mind? Share it with us. Thanks.
It's 10:59. Headlines from NPR News, just 2 minutes away.
Support for KUOW comes from the physicians of Proliance East Side Ear, Nose, and Throat, whose surgeons specializing in snoring have offered the Pillar procedure, a minimally invasive 15-minute in-office snoring treatment since 2004. Information online at StopSnoringSeattle.com.
This is Patricia Murphy. KUOW would like to thank all the new and renewing members who helped make our recent pledge drive a success. If you didn't have a chance to pledge during the drive, it's not too late to support KUOW. Mail your gift in today. And thanks.
44 degrees, overcast in Seattle. We're expecting a high today of 48. Clouds and showers with a chance of thunderstorms. Clouds and showers tonight as well. Chance of evening thunderstorms, the low near 35. Then tomorrow, partly sunny with a chance of rain. Tomorrow's high near 49.
Support for KUOW comes from Elliott Bay Book Company. Author Henning Mankell signs and reads from his 10th book in the Kurt Vollander mystery series, The Troubled Man from Knopf, Friday, April 8th, 7 p.m. at Seattle Public Central Library. Info at elliottbaybook.com.
KUOW FM 94.9 Seattle, KUOW 1340 AM Tumwater, Olympia, a service.